Well, welcome. Good to see you, each of you. And this is a running seminar. I'm delighted that John von Hiking's able to be with us. John is a professor of political science at the University of Lethbridge. So he drove up this morning through the beautiful landscape of Alberta.
Indeed.
And, of course, John Johansson comes from Lethbridge, so we brought him just for John. He teaches in political philosophy, religion, and politics at Lethbridge, is the author of Augustine and Politics as Longing in the World. There are only 5 copies left on Amazon.com, so I suspect that some of you may leave early in order to get yours.
Or leave early for other reasons.
John is the co-editor of a volume that's coming out shortly from Notre Dame on Friendship and Politics, Essays in Political Thought. And I understand that the essay in there, for those of you that still maintain some connection to Martin Luther and John Calvin, that essay actually points out that in Luther and Calvin there is no friendship. That is something we do not know here at Augustana or in Camrose. He has written extensively about friendship, about war, Islamic politics, about deliberative democracy, political prophecy, about the great sort of Promethean scholar Eric Vogeland, and about religion and politics in Canada. He's going to speak today using this as an opportunity to work through some of his current work. Is political friendship possible in the modern world? So I'm delighted you've taken the time to come with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I've never been to Augustana before, so this is a real treat, and thank you for sharing your lunch hour with me, and I hope in the next hour and a half or so that we can have some fruitful discussion. As David noticed, my theme today is asking whether political friendship is possible in the modern age. And in a sense, to ask such a question is to make a counter proposal or to resist a central thrust to what we generally consider to be modern or part of modern society, because the people like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, the philosophers who kind of argued and gave a philosophical defense of modern society, postulated that political society is based on a contract. And they did so in opposition to an older view that one finds throughout ancient Greece, Aristotle, Plato, even through the Middle Ages, St. Thomas Aquinas, and so forth. That older model that saw politics as a species of friendship or political friendship. And the main reason they did so is because that older model demanded too much from human character. It kind of set the bar too high. And so as a result, it made political life too contentious. So in order to have a peaceful realm, you need to kind of take a few things off the table and lower the bar, lower the standard of what people can agree upon. Unfortunately, what many critics have argued is that this notion of, well, you can have this public-private distinction, this notion of, well, you have a contract for the public, but you can kind of leave your private relationships untouched by this public understanding, this public self. That kind of public-private split is a little bit too neat. Evidence of this is a growing worry that even in our private lives, that friendships are eroding, or people's capabilities of practicing and also thinking and speaking about friendship is slowly eroding. And I'll just give you one example. This was taken from a study in the American Sociological Review that came out last year that found that a quarter of Americans say they have no one with whom they can discuss personal troubles. so no one to console with. That's more than double who were similarly isolated in 1985. Overall, the number of people Americans have in their closest circle of confidants has dropped from around 3 to about 2. And they're looking specifically at those relationships that people have that reside outside the family, outside one's marriage bonds. So they're looking at friendship relationships that are not kind of connected to the family. Of course, the question of the family today is a whole other question, which we don't need to get into. So it seems that there seems to be a corrosion that this public way of thinking about ourselves, this public way of constructing our political society as a contract, as kind of we're bargainers, has a way of creeping into the way we structure our relationships in the private realm. And as a result, it's corroded our sensibilities, it's corroded the ways we've practiced friendship, and also how we speak about it. And I want to keep the speaking about it and the practice of it kind of together in tandem. And in order to do it, I want to take a look at, well, the ideas on friendship in 5 different political thinkers. 3 of them are what we call pre-modern, so specifically Aristotle, Plato, and Augustine. And 2 modern thinkers, Alexis de Tocqueville, who was probably the greatest observer theorist of modern democracy, and also Soren Kierkegaard, all of whom try to treat friendship in the following way. For all of these thinkers, the modern society or ancient society, politics, the emotional bonds that ground a political society, are in a sense an analog of a higher form of friendship, a higher level of friendship, what Aristotle called friendship of the good, or as I've written down here, what Aristotle calls in the Greek term is synesthesis, which I just put up a literal translation of joint perception or joint perception of the good, and I'll explain what that means in a minute. All of these thinkers, in one way or another, use this model as a way of anchoring their understandings of the highest forms of friendship, and it's the practice, and it's also the, oh, I suppose I should stand over here by the mic. It's the practice of that and the reflection in that that helps them to articulate what a political society is about, which is not to say that a political society is something that they expect to have the same level of intimacy or civic or moral virtue that two people or 4 people or 5 people of very high intellectual and moral character hold. But at the same time, the point of it is that politics may not make you good, but you need good people to make good politics. So there's kind of a top-down causation going on here. I mean, it's not completely top-down, but there's something like that. It's a bit of an analog. And so the 5 thinkers that I'll discuss for the next few minutes treat synesthetic friendship in the following way. Well, for Aristotle, friendship is joint perception of the good. It involves loving one's friend or friends whom one regards as the image of the gods, what Aristotle calls God's kinesis, the movement of the divine through the human. Similarly, Plato, in one of his dialogues called the Phaedrus, said friendship is that which is enjoyed among friends in the bond of the cosmic river. He uses mythological elements to describe the emotional, intellectual experience of synesthetic friendship, whom one regards, and this is Plato's language, the icon of the god. Of course, with Augustine, once we turn to Christianity, it's a much more explicit account of, we're talking about friends living, one's friend is the image of God, and the love that one shares with the image of God, he symbolizes it as Holy Spirit. Now, when you get to the modern age, of course, a lot of this representational language, image, icon, gets removed. And in a sense, that is part of the equation when people like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke set up kind of the contract basis of society. You're no longer talking about what is being represented. What is this human personality in front of you? What's in front of you is matter in motion. That's kind of the notion of Hobbes, which Locke kind of updates. The reason I choose Tocqueville and Kierkegaard is because, first off, they're a little bit worried about where Hobbes and Locke and this contract model lead you. But moreover, they're trying to retrieve a sense of this image language, this icon language, and trying to figure out how to articulate the bond that exists between lover and beloved, friend and friend. And so Tocqueville's symbol is loving the friend as an image of humanity, but a humanity that is somehow absent and present at the same time. Kierkegaard views friendship as loving the image of the god, not as an image per se, but he always refers to Socrates. You turn inward. In turning inward, we turn outward. In turning inward, we see the other. So in the time allotted, I'll try to spell out some of this. But before doing that, I want to give you a kind of a better basis of what Aristotle means by Sunnis thesis. And the best way to get to that is actually go to the quotation in the Nicomachean Ethics where he states the term. And on your handout that I handed out, I skipped the first part, actually. The first quotation I list there is actually from Nietzsche, which is a way of kind of a vivid way of expressing this corrosion of friendship. So we'll just kind of pass over that simply because I already made my point that I wanted to make with Nietzsche. But the quote on Aristotle I want to point to is quotation number 2. Aristotle, this is near the end of his discussion of friendship, and you have to understand Aristotle's kind of building he's always working on a crescendo, so he's near the end of his discussion of friendship, what friendship really means, after he's kind of sifted through the different partial definitions and partial explanations. So he writes, "Therefore, one also ought to share in a friend's awareness that he is, and this would come through living together and sharing conversation and thinking. For this would seem to be what living together means in the case of human beings." And so he says that because we become aware of ourselves, our moral powers, our intellectual powers are fully activated. And he says, as a result, as a matter of course, therefore, because we could become fully conscious of ourselves, we are also fully conscious of our friend, fully conscious of another. So another way of saying that is, you know, to share in the awareness that he is, or I've put in brackets, or share in one's friend's consciousness of his existence. So this is what Aristotle refers to as the other self, but I think it's important and actually fairly problematic in a lot of ways, because for Aristotle, the gap between humans, in some ways, becomes very minimized. Of course, you are fully aware of the consciousness of somebody else. To be another self is not only to love another as yourself, but to love you as much as you love another person. And it should be stressed here that what Aristotle is suggesting is not kind of a merged self model by which, you know, I am I, you are you. This is, you know, a later model that one sees during the Renaissance. But rather, when we fully activate our moral and intellectual capabilities, that's when we are, in a sense, the most individual. That's when we are the most, have the greatest integrity of our personality. As a result, this is when we are most capable of practicing friendship. And I think I want to kind of belabor that a little bit, simply because when one gets to modern political philosophy, when it gets to somebody like Hobbes or John Locke, or you see this among romantics even, for them, the full activation of one's intellectual powers, reason, actually leads to solitude. It leads to solitude. Not so for Aristotle or for the other thinkers amongst the pre-moderns that I'm mentioning. So friendship as the apex of moral action, as the apex of intellectual action, it becomes what Robert Spemann, who's a German theologian or philosophical theologian, calls awakening to reality. It is the most real of experiences. And also, the other thing to keep in mind, that for Aristotle, moral action, the truth of moral action is not to be found in a treatise or in laws or in axioms, but rather the truth of moral action is to be found in the action itself, in the actual moral choices that the fully aware, fully activated human being makes. And as a result, it makes it very difficult to theorize, to reflect upon, to write about moral action, and then especially friendship. Because he tells us this experience of saying that, you know, because our moral faculties are fully activated, we become conscious of another's existence. It's not really clear, just from that sentence and from the text in the Ethics, what Aristotle fully means by that. And this is why in my work, one of the things that I've done is actually try to kind of piece together from other parts of Aristotle's work to try to see how he understands that notion of sunus thesis. And the basic way that he understands it is in terms of drama, or tragedy, or festivals. In ancient Greece, tragedies were civic festivals. They were expressions of one's citizenship, not in kind of a rah-rah flag-waving way, but in a reflective way, at least the best tragedies. And so instead of looking at some of his ethical or political writings, what I've done is looked at a treatise that Aristotle writes on the nature of the tragic arts, the poetics, as it's called. And the reason I do that is because in explaining what tragedy is about, in explaining what the theatric arts are about, Aristotle not only tells us, you know, what makes a good play, what makes a good drama, you know, what are the different parts that should be included in a tragedy, he also gives us an explanation of the moral transformation that the spectator would undergo in observing a well-done tragedy. So by explaining this, by putting us in the seat of the spectator, what he is doing is giving us kind of an account of the development of our practical intellects. So he doesn't give us kind of an axiomatic expression of, okay, here's friendship, here's moral ethics. Rather, what he does is say, okay, you guys go to the theater, you go to movies, you go to the, you know, see plays. You sympathize with the characters. You have pity for them. You fear for them. You can see how they are engaged in deliberations as they respond to different events during the drama. And you can also see with them that if they choose A, they'll choose well. If they choose B, not so well. And so if they choose B, you go, oh no, because you know what's going to happen. And by doing that, so you're exercising your practical intellect into friendship, into sunus thesis. And the reason for that is twofold. First, you're sympathizing with that character. You can recognize in that character that you yourself share a similar world, a similar human condition, because you too, we too, also face these difficult choices. Similarly, that character is not evil, but not particularly noble either. Aristotle says the best tragedies involve characters who are decent. And the reason for that is because they're decent. They want to do well, but they have a tragic flaw. They have a flaw that they regard as their greatest strength, but their greatest strength turns into their downfall. We all have that. We all have that blind spot. And so Aristotle sees our activity of spectating at a civic theater as an expression of moral instruction, moral engagement, kind of exercising your moral capacities, and at the same time engaging them together. because you're kind of vicariously thinking along with the choices that the characters make. And so I have a wonderful summary quote on that connection between the practical intellect that gets exercised into friendship and the what Aristotle calls the mimetic arts. And it's number 4. And it's one of the scholars on Aristotle who writes, "It is the distinctive feature of human action that whenever we choose what to do, we imagine an action for ourselves as though we are inspecting it from the outside. Intentions are nothing more than imagined actions, internalizations of the external. All action is therefore imitation of action. It is poetic." So in other words, whenever we make a moral choice, we have in our imaginations the end product that we expect to see, that we hope to see. Of course, things don't always turn out that way because of chance, because of fortune or whatnot, because of our blindness in a certain sense. But the structure of the moral choice always sees it as an end. And the only time we actually can see a moral choice that has a beginning, middle, and end is when we view a tragedy, when we view a drama. And so that's how it becomes this moral exercise. And this connection you make with the character, because you also share that common human world with that character. I also had a number 3, a quotation that Aristotle from his Politics, which is actually one of my favorite statements of Aristotle, and it kind of gets this notion of festivity, of storytelling, of myth, of plot, of narrative, and how that fits together with his political understanding. And he writes, "And elsewhere, Odysseus says that this is the best pastime, when human beings are enjoying good cheer and the banqueters, seated in order throughout the hall, listen to a singer." And of course, Odysseus says that in Book 9 of the Odyssey, where he is giving an account of his story to the Phaeacians, who are this noble divine race who eventually help him get back to Ithaca. So it has a very important dramatic point in the drama of the Odyssey. And of course, Odysseus has strange relationships with his friends too. You know, gets them turned into pigs and all that sort of stuff. Okay, so that's enough for Aristotle, and I hope that's given you a bit of a skeletal outline on what I'm up to and kind of the problem, the moral and even religious problem that I'm addressing with these thinkers. Because as I turn to Plato, Plato I think gives us a deepened account, an even religious account of synesthesis that is a little bit shallower, if you will, than the Aristotle's is shallower than one finds in Plato. And I look to one of Plato's dialogues called the Phaedrus. And in that dialogue, it's the only dialogue, incidentally, where Socrates is outside the city. All of the other dialogues has Socrates with his interlocutors inside the city. This one, he's outside, and right there, the dramatic setting is very important, because I think what we're doing, as we'll see, the realities that Socrates discusses transcend politics. They're above politics. He has to return to the city, but the realities of which they discuss are outside. He and his friend, or they're not really friends, acquaintance, Phaedrus, discuss love. And Phaedrus has given us a speech related by one of the Athenian sophists, Lysias, that says that it is base, it is servile to desire. Because we all know, maybe we've all experienced it at one point or another, when we desire someone, when we have the sight of our beloved in our target eyesight, we'll grovel, we'll get on our hands and knees, we're willing to humiliate ourselves for that beloved. And so Lysias, whose speech that Phaedrus relates, says, rather, what needs to be done is that one must become the non-lover. One must be aloof, because then we all know that if somebody isn't or shows they're not interested, then you've got them. And what one finds in the speech of Lysias and in Phaedrus, who admires this speech, is the crassest of manipulation. Phaedrus is a materialist. He sees love only as a matter of satisfying physical desires. James Rhodes, who's one of the most insightful Plato scholars, points out that Phaedrus and Lysias represent a kind of a decadent Athenian democracy. He calls it a tyrannical democratic eros, in the sense of everybody's equal because they're all kind of a bundle of pains and pleasures seeking satisfaction, but it's tyrannical because they want to be number one. So it's a very decadent, it's a speech that reflects a decadent democratic myth of autonomy, as we would say today. So Socrates, who's always in conversation with people who are maybe not so philosophical, not maybe because they're less intelligent, but because they have deformed souls. They have tyrannical eros in them. He counters this decadent. This is Socrates' attempt, his civic obligation, if you will, his attempt to try to save, at some level, the souls of Athenians. And so, as a result, he provides a response to this myth of autonomy. And he says that eros is a gift. Eros is a gift of the gods. It is a kind of mania. And so, I'm going to speak as a prophet. I'm going to say that mania is philosophic, and the philosophers are also the greatest lovers of beauty. And so, in contrast to the myth of autonomy, Socrates will say, no, you're completely helpless to a large degree in the experience of erotics that's rushing through our souls. Now, he also concocts a myth. He says the soul is eternal. We have to think of the soul as something that transcends the body. So Socrates is trying to lift Phaedrus' gaze above his bodily desires to try to see all of his emotions as simply products of his of physiology. So he comes up with a myth that says, before we were born, we were all souls who were following the stars. We were following the circle of the heavens, and we were contemplating Zeus. But some people fell away. So if you fell away the quickest and fell down to earth because you chose to follow baser desires, well, those people were tyrants. And then he kind of comes with a nine-point hierarchy of different kinds of souls. You know, the ones who stick around the longest gazing at Zeus, those are the philosophers, those are the true lovers of beauty. But even so, eventually even the philosophers drop down, they are born. It's kind of a myth of eternal recurrence, or it's a myth of karma, if you will. You drop down, and when you fall in love with someone, it's because that person reminds you of the image of the divine that you recollect. So he gives us a myth of recollection, of anamnesis, to use the Greek. So when you behold your beloved, you shudder. You are kind of transported out of yourself. It's an act of ecstasy. You know, your beloved's face flashes like lightning. And you feel a yearning. You feel like you're going to grow feathers and fly with your beloved. Now, when going through the dialogue of the Phaedrus, there's a lot of homoerotic symbolism going on. But at the same time, what Socrates is doing is saying that these are realities that transcend the body, that that erotics is ultimately about beauty and what he calls the love of the essence really being, that flashes like lightning in the mystical ascent. So he has this wonderful statement where he talks about the two now friends, they're not lovers anymore, he calls them friends, philia is in the Greek, of how they behold one another. It's a wonderful passage, that's quote number 5 in the outline. It says, "And just as a breeze, or perhaps an echo, springing from smooth and solid objects, is borne back whence it set forth, so the flow of beauty, going back into the beautiful one through the eyes," right? Note the eyes, "arrives where it is naturally disposed to go into the soul and sets them on a wing. It waters the wings' passages and urges on the growing of the wings and fills the beloved soul in its turn full of love. Therefore, he loves. But what? He is at a loss. He does not know what he has experienced, nor can he tell. But just as someone who has caught ophthalmia, eye disease, from another is not able to state the cause, so it escaped his notice that he is seeing himself in the mirror in the love. It's a complicated but beautiful passage. The descent, the beholding of one's friend is an ecstatic event. It is an act of recollection. One recollects the good, that one's friend is not only, you know, kind of a reminder of the good, but the good is truly present. The Greek term that Socrates uses is hemeros. In Greek mythology, hemeros was the brother of Eros and was largely described as yearning, as longing. Here, Socrates has spiritualized it more than what one finds in, you know, a lot of Greek myths. But the notion here is that it's a, you feel your soul drawn. It's a passive experience. You feel your soul drawn. Now, what are we to make of the myth? Well, as with all of the myths that one finds in Socratic dialogues, they shouldn't be taken literally. But what they are doing is articulating experiences that cannot be articulated kind of directly or through kind of geometric or axiomatic type of language. A myth tells a story. It gets you into that story to reflect. And here, I think what the myth, kind of in addition to some of the things that I've said here, what it helps us explain is this experience of when we behold someone with whom we share a long-standing friendship, a love, that person is there as a reminder. Eros, Rhodes says, comes to us as anamnesis, as recollection. And a wonderful summary quotation, statement, is by actually an Aristotle scholar, and this is number six. By perceiving you, perceiving in this way, I catch myself in the act of perceiving. I witness the bloom of your actualization in the face of some object, and simultaneously feel my own actualization, which rebounds in your enlivened perception of my perception. You can feel hemeros swashing back and forth like the Holy Spirit here. This experience of seeing and feeling, the controvertibility of the moment, is itself soon aesthetic. So it's the self-awakening in conjunction at almost simultaneously with one's beloved. One feels one's potentiality drawn out. So this mythological language of yearning, of getting drawn out, if you were to translate into some slightly more technical Aristotelian language, would mean you'd be feeling your potency go into act. And it's something that happens to you. Okay. How are we doing? Oh, wow, okay. So, Augustine, I'll be a little bit more brief with Augustine. Augustine describes friendship as the bond of the Holy Spirit between two friends. This is in Book 4 of the Confessions. Now, what I do in my work is I talk about, you know, how his treatment of friendship in the Confessions with the drama of the development that leads up to the conversion scene, and how his friends play an important role in his salvific history, how these particular human beings have their own unique status as agents of the divine. In a sense, Augustine also has this dramatic understanding of soon aesthetic friendship. In his theological, or more explicit theological writings on the Trinity, at one point there, he describes that the persons of the Trinity, you know, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, relate to one another as friends. And he says that the reason for this is because one substance, three persons. So there's a unity, but there's multiplicity. And the relationship of that multiplicity in that unity is one of friendship. And so, in a sense, I mean, Augustine, probably more than any of the other thinkers I've listed here, just loves to go through analogies. And he says that the human soul is an analogy of the Trinity, memory, will, and understanding. Well, so too is friendship an analogy of the Trinity. So too, I argue, his understanding of political society is an analogy of friendship. So there's kind of a whole series of ascending scales going on in which Augustine discusses this paradox, and it is a paradox, I mean, or a mystery is probably the better term, that the Trinity, as three persons, one substance, expresses, well, we use friendship to describe this as a way of saying that friends share a commonality, share a common substance, but yet they are distinct. They are separate persons. Similar to the way that Aristotle describes two friends as two distinct individualities, because only then can friendship be practiced. Similarly, with Augustine, the persons of the Trinity are analogs or analogates of friendship. And if I think what I'll do is I'll just kind of finish with Augustine there, and if you have questions and afterwards, I'd be happy to address those, because I only have about 10 minutes left, and I also want to cover Tocqueville and Kierkegaard. I'm going to have to kind of condense it a little bit. Tocqueville wrote a book called Democracy in America in the 1830s, and it's considered today to be probably the most important book, not just on America, but as Tocqueville emphasized, it's about democracy, or democracy that happens to be in America. So he's looking at democracy as a type, as a genus. And it's not just the institutions, it's not just the, you know, elections, and it's not just political party behavior, you know, the sort of things that my colleagues at the U of L study, but rather it's about the mores, Tocqueville calls, the culture, the ideas, the sentiments that form the laws. So he's a 19th century French sociologist who sees that laws are largely products of the culture that creates them. And he says that the primary attribute of a democratic culture is individualism. And this is number 7 on the handout. And he says that individualism is separate from egoism. It's separate from greed. Individualism is specific to democracy. And he calls it a reflective and peaceable sentiment that disposes each citizen to isolate himself from the mass of those like him and to withdraw to one side with his family and his friends, so that after having thus created a little society for his own use, he willingly abandons society at large to itself. So the private contracts, the private sphere contracts to your immediate surroundings. You kind of let public society be run by the administrators, by your representatives. Today we have political scientists who express concern that, well, only 60% turnout for the federal election or things like that. Voter apathy, things that get expressed like this. One of the reasons why there's an individualism is because Democrats are skeptics. They see themselves as their own authorities of the good. They rely on their own eyes to see. They rely on their own heads to think through what is the good life. Now, there's something salutary about that, but the downside of that is that they, by relying too much on themselves, they forget about the great conversation that can exist among others. So they lose a sense of place, they lose a sense of being part of a tradition, of a civilization, and so forth. And so Tocqueville says that the great danger for modern democracy is that people become idiots. Not just in the way we use that term, but in the original sense, meaning somebody who is a private person, whose soul is closed. But he says that modern democracy is ingenious in its design because it does hold out a possibility for preventing idiocy And he refers to civil associations, civil society, churches, unions, clubs, schools, interest groups, political parties, all these so-called mediating institutions that sociologists and political scientists study that allow individuals in democracy to participate, but also to undergo a moral education, if not conversion. And he describes the conversion in number 8. Where he writes, when you participate in these things, sentiments and ideas renew themselves, the heart is enlarged, the human mind is developed only by the reciprocal action of men upon action. So it's through practice that the truth of democracy comes out. Tocqueville always says that Democrats have a very difficult time explaining their form of government, their way of life. I mean, you know, you just... true today especially, but Tocqueville was looking at this in the 1830s and 1840s, and he said that what has to be done is you have to see the action as it plays itself out. The truth is in the action. It's kind of it's even an Aristotelian point about moral ethics. But that only goes so far. You see, Tocqueville took his bearings from Pascal. And he thinks that in an important way, so did moderns, so do Democrats. Because surrounding our life, surrounding our society, our concrete existence, is a complete uncertainty of where we're going, where we have come from. And so Tocqueville suffered a crisis of faith, and he sort of says that this is a very common and almost representative thing for people in modernity to have happen to them. And so in quote number 10 is where he describes his own crisis of faith, and I'll just point out one point of it. He says, strong passions drew me out of the state of despair. They turned me away from the sight of these intellectual ruins, you know, where he was trying to find faith. He was trying to prove it to himself. But these strong passions led me toward tangible objects. And he kind of has a dual sense of what tangible objects means. On the one hand, you know, sensory perception, you know, we're still in the world, right? How can we infer the reality of God, salvation, redemption from, you know, physical matter, from nature, and so forth? But tangible objects also has another way, meaning for Tocqueville, which is kind of like the way that Aristotle speaks of the activation of moral powers. For Aristotle, you waken to reality in your full activation of your powers. And I think that's the sort of experience that Tocqueville is searching for, but he can't find it. He's either too modern, or he doesn't have the philosophical equipment to think sufficiently rigorous about it. So he's kind of floundering. So he thinks, well, maybe practice, maybe the life in politics is the way of experience, a tangibility, a reality of human existence, but that's disappointing. And so, finally, he says, in the quote number 11, he says, I have only to consider myself. This is his great Pascalian statement. Man comes from nothing, traverses time, and is going to disappear forever into the bosom of God. One sees him only for a moment, wandering, lost between the limits of two abysses.
Cheery thought.
Pardon?
Cheery thought.
Cheery thought, yeah, yeah. So... you know, if we think of friendship in the context of icon or image of God, as Plato does or Aristotle does, there's nothing to image here for Tocqueville. What does he see when he looks across the room or when he beholds his friend? I'll read it to you. And as to getting on good terms with people, this is number 12, I could not do so in any general or systematic fashion, for there are so few whom I recognize. Whenever there is nothing in a man's thoughts or feelings that strikes me, I, so to speak, do not see him. I have always supposed that mediocrities as well as men of parts had a nose, mouth, and eyes, but I have never been able to fix in my memory the forms that those features take in each particular case. It is not that I despise them, but I have a little truck with them, feeling that they are like so many clichés. So he's expressing something that Kierkegaard is going to express, that Heidegger expresses, that human life in the modernity is being surrounded by the clichés, the people who are other, kind of these objects. So we're kind of left at a dead end with Tocqueville, but at least he has raised the issues. He has diagnosed the problem. And just in the final couple minutes, I just want to raise a couple points that Kierkegaard raises. Kierkegaard has a very similar diagnosis to the problems of this loss of this corrosion of moral capacities and also corrosion of the practice of friendship that Tocqueville does. He called himself the enemy of Christendom because Christendom has turned us all into hypocrites and turned us all into people who kind of have the exteriors, the externals, but there's no interior. And so Kierkegaard is in his religious writings, in his philosophical writings, always return to this notion of the inward turn, that speculative philosophy, by which he means mostly Hegel, but others, kind of turns us outward. And because it turns us outward, it makes us ignorant of ourselves. He points to Socrates as the great example of ethical knowledge. Socrates wasn't interested in speculative philosophy. His first and foremost question was, how do I live? That is the ethical question. That is to turn philosophy towards its true meaning, but also toward becoming concrete. So Kierkegaard always contrasts the abstract, the speculative, with the concrete. The concrete is the ethical. The concrete is seeking self-knowledge. And he's also very interested. One of the criticisms that Kierkegaard has of actually friendship and also of erotics, you know, one finds in poetry, is that you turn your beloved into an object. They become finite. But love of God is infinite. It is for an infinite object. In fact, it's not for an object. Its love is non-existent in a kind of paradoxic way. It's not like he's an atheist, but he's not. He wants to get away from a notion that, you know, there's a God who is an object among different objects of the world. And so by treating the turn inward as a turn toward this paradoxic non-existence, love then becomes non-existent, but not missing, but rather not having an object. And I'll just mention a few quotations here that he is, it kind of spells this out. Number 18 is a good way. The only true object of a human being's love is love, which is God, which therefore, in a more profound sense, is not any object, since he is love itself. Now, this love is also sociable. Okay, Kierkegaard, there's a tendency to read Kierkegaard as a hyper-individualist, that is completely a turn inward, it's solipsistic. But in fact, the turn inward is a prelude to a deepened sense of a turn outward. And this is captured by a couple of other quotations that I have. Number 17 will work. A believer is infinitely interested in the actuality of another. For faith, this is decisive, and this interestedness is not just a little inquisitiveness, but is absolute dependence on the object of faith. The object of faith is the actuality of another person. Its relation is an infinite interestedness. But for what the advantage of Kierkegaard's meditations on love here, the reason why, kind of what brings them this a unique contribution to the debate that's a little different than one finds in the other thinkers, is that, first off, he looks to Socrates. He looks to Socratic eros, like that I described in the Phaedrus. He mentions the Phaedrus on a couple of occasions, as saying this is a paradigm not only for philosophy, but for ethical living and for love, because the Socratic eros, Socrates turned inward. He wanted to see, you know, who am I? How should I live? But at the same time, this also made him a fully human individual. But then there's a paradox. Who was Socrates' friend? Socrates practiced irony. For Socrates, there is a distance between himself and the other. Now, this distance is deeper or more profound than this they notion, or this notion of, you know, we're living in this in this kind of world of anonymous other people that we just kind of bump into. This distance between Socrates and his interlocutors, or as I argue, Kierkegaard and his readers, is actually a deepened friendship. And Kierkegaard calls it a deepened friendship, but maybe not one we're totally familiar with. Because for Kierkegaard, the ultimate expression of love is self-giving. It's self-giving. And he says in one of his Christian writings near the end of his life, he writes that, this is in number 20, I won't read the entire quotation, but he's saying, this is how I understand what my relationship is with my reader. I don't know who you are. I'm offering this, but you do me a greater favor in reading it than I do for you in writing it. Which is to say that I'm not doing you a favor. I don't expect a response. But in my offering this gift to you, your reciprocity, even though I don't ask for it, the fact that you give it is a greater gift. And so I think what he's doing is in not so much in kind of his specific kind of logical statements that one finds, but in his practice of writing, in his authorship, which is kind of a complicated issue, one does find a paradigm for not an intimate form of friendship for the modern world, but one that kind of outlines its possibility and also kind of shows how we can make a virtue out of distance. And you know, since I was able to drive 4 hours today and make a virtue out of distance, I'll just leave it at that for today and maybe open it up for some comments and discussion. So,
well, yeah. Maybe going in two directions. How do you practice political friendship in a modern university?
And that's even harder than in a modern democracy.
Yeah, and exactly. So,
yeah.
Because a lot of the things that you're saying makes me think, okay, well, you know, are we actually undermining it in, you know, the modern academic institutions, the possibility of friendship, which hasn't, and if that's, if we are, well, we're not, I guess we're not civil society, but we could be. We could have parts of civil society, and if that's what mediates individualism to our political common life, mm-hmm. you know, if that atrophies at the university, then what chances do we have for political friendship out?
Yeah, if the university is actually a multiversity, mm-hmm. then if these are kind of the moral and intellectual habits that we as professors, as teachers, are inculcating. That's a really hard question to answer, and maybe I can.
Well, you don't drive 4 hours for easy questions.
Yeah, no. Maybe I can come at it from a certain angle and see what you think of this. One of the ways that could be answered is to say, well, the university can be unified by having a core curriculum, by having a common narrative, a common set of readings. Right, this is kind of the great big, you know, academic fight of the last 30 or 40 years, right? The, you know, the so-called Western canon, and then of course, well, who gets included, who gets excluded, and, you know, all the academic infighting. And meanwhile, the scientists are saying, well, students can come over here because clearly the humanities people don't know what they're doing. But I think in some ways that debate is a little bit misplaced. I mean, yes, you want to have students, you know, not only kind of knowing who Odysseus was as kind of their stock of mythical figures and friends, in a sense, that they can go through life. And, you know, you want, you know, one of the ways we can gauge our success as teachers is to say, well, you know, upon graduation and going off into the world, if a student at one point in their life, when they're faced with an ethical dilemma, might ask, what would Dostoevsky say? Or what might Jane Austen say, right? And because they remember thinking through those questions in university, and and that makes them kind of more critically aware of the world around them and able to relate to other people in friendship relationships. But at the same time, I'm kind of a skeptic about the Western canon or the notion of the common readings, simply because, obviously there are good books, and then there's great books, and there's also books that are better off just ignoring. But even the bad ones sometimes have really surprising things in them. And in a sense, that's what learning is about, the sudden surprise. Here, I found this, I didn't realize it was here before, is that act of liberation that one has. So, in a certain sense, the worry about universities perhaps inculcating bad friendship habits might be a little bit overdrawn, simply because one can find good teachers, good books, good experiences like that in the classroom. I suppose the problem is that it's not by design. Students kind of have to, they don't get led to these learning experiences, at least in most kind of composite major universities. It's by luck that I ended up having X, Y, and Z as a great teacher going through. But at the same time, you can imagine that if you did have that prescribed those prescribed curriculum work in some places, but not so much in others. Right. I mean, it's liberal arts colleges. I don't know what you have here at Augustana, if you have
the core.
You have the core, yeah. So, in a certain
we're
sense, it's a 4-year project, right, mm-hmm. to develop this human being who starts off, usually at the age of 18, not knowing what up and down, left and right, mm-hmm. right, and hopefully by the time they reach that when they graduate, they have that greater intellectual and moral character. But they're getting it from all sides. So I don't know if that. It is, in a sense, it's a practice question, right? It's, yeah.
Maybe this will be an easier one. If you can distinguish, if there's a distinction between political friendship and just friendship.
Yeah. Political friendship. Well, politics is a composite or a compound of all the different levels of human reality. So as citizens, we're members of political society, and we, obviously give things, and political society gives back. So, we have expectations that our political society will be able to provide a certain peace and security, certain material well-being, healthcare, paved roads, things like that. We don't expect to have the highest and most intimate types of friendship we experience to deliver paved roads. We do expect a couple of things, or we do hope for, that our political society can give shelter, can even maybe facilitate those deeper forms of friendship. Okay. On the other hand, political society, if it doesn't have people who are practiced in those deeper, more intimate kinds, those in many ways more demanding kinds, political society needs to draw upon a well of moral character that in and of itself may or may not be able to generate, but it can at least we expect that it should protect it. But in protecting it, it also requires people to develop these moral characters so that the people who go into politics or make decisions on our behalf have developed ethical habits in sympathy, in being able literally to see a problem from someone else's perspective, right? And so we need those deeper forms of friendship to inform the political practice. The moral habits that I've mentioned, these are kind of expected from the higher forms of friendship, this from politics. They're not kind of vacuum-closed spheres, right? Obviously, in friendships, which are smaller in number but maybe deeper, you can get into the danger of, you just talk to an echo chamber, right? Well, these are your friends who share your own political opinions, they're the same religion, they drive the same truck or whatever. That's not going to work very well in a larger plurality. right? So you, the both of those experiences, the ethical, if you will, and the political, have to work off one another and develop each other. But their purposes are a little bit different, I think.
Yeah. As you talked about the encounter with the other and the turning inwards that occurs and the deepening self-knowledge and regard for the other that emerges from that, I was thinking a little bit about, suppose it's the question of our political discourse around friendship and how our political discourse has become so, also exists in such restricted silos.
Yeah.
We had a little incident here when we actually launched the Ramin Center, of having three politicians sitting together in the foyer out here. And I was very, very struck by it, because for an hour or so, they took off their political, their party hats,
yeah,
as I like to call them.
Yeah.
I think it's a kind of nice phrase.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Masks.
They took off their party hats, and they sat. It was kicked off really by a discussion initially between Walter McLean, who was in Mill Rooney's cabinet, and has had a long relationship to Africa and deep concerns about Canada's relationship to various parts of Africa. And Bill Blakey.
Okay. Yeah.
Of course, long-serving member of parliament and member of the NDP. And they talked about sitting in Africa together. And both of them have some, you know, tragically Scots ancestry. It's not easy for them. But it did mean they shared a beverage.
Oh, yes.
So they talked about their work on a committee, a joint committee in Africa, and how they saw things together and began to think together at night over single malt scotch,
mm-hmm,
about how our nation might do some work, or various sectors of our nation might do some work to alleviate some of the suffering that was going on. And as I listened to this, I thought, my oh my, what a, how sad it is that within our public political discourse, this kind of narrative, this kind of story, this kind of encounter, mm-hmm, is simply so rare. I mean, we rarely read or hear anything about this.
Yeah.
Because the political discourse, I mean, what I think, I don't think there's any question. I glimpsed friendship there,
yeah,
between these men.
Yeah.
And Walter McLean, or Walter Malone from Cameron, who served also in on Parliament, during Parliament, was there and you know, equally drew up several stories associated with this for them as well. So I don't know what the question is here, but in terms of the discourse and the way we think about politics, and that there is a kind of friendship that exists, but that the way we seek to control political discourse actually dumbs down. It makes us all much more idiotic,
yeah,
than we in fact are.
Yeah.
And in fact the experience bears witness,
yeah,
to.
I guess I'd have two observations on that. One of it is it's a function of the difference between friendship and politics. Part of the Phaedrus dialogue that I didn't cover is about rhetoric, where after Socrates gives a speech, he and Phaedrus discuss good, proper rhetoric. And one of the main distinctions that Socrates draws is that laws are clumsy. Laws, like giving a speech, actually, assume that the audience, assume that the polity is homogenous. So laws are dumb. Whereas an individual loving, speaking to, encountering another individual is, you know, correspondingly intelligent, because one can adapt to the particularities, the background, the situation of that individual. And so Socrates says that, you know, political rhetoric is like laws, it's kind of dumb. But dialectic, and for Socrates, dialectic, this one-on-one conversation back and forth, is much more profound and much more just, actually, than laws can ever be. I mean, this kind of gets back to John's question on political friendship versus friendship, that friendship allows you to have that attentiveness to the individual existence of another person, whereas political friendship necessarily has to be dumbed down. Not in a vulgar sense all the time, but it, you know, when you're comparing these two phenomena, I think, yes, it is dumber. The other point, or the other observation, would be a lot of this is aggravated by living in a mass society, right? We don't know our representatives, right? The origin of the term riding, right, as in, you know, who's your MP, who represents this riding, is that the MP, your representative, could cross the riding in one day riding on horseback.
You need a pretty strong and fast horse these days.
It doesn't work in Western Canada, right? might work in, you know, in Upper and Lower Canada, right? But even so, you have some familiarity with your representative. There is that accountability, there is that responsibility, which I don't want to say it's missing today, but it's much more mediated as a result through the media, right? And of course, you know, the media is in a sense a placebo or an artificial kind of common substance now. They're the messengers. You know, if Eros was the messenger of the gods or at least a kind of messenger, well, now we've got the media, which is to our loss.
Maybe just following up on that, in Obima, it was created by our whatever government to have, you know, a chief and counselors, but they still have a tradition, and it's predominantly the women who gather and talk. And so that layered conversation happens, and the council will always, because they have their own chamber just next to council chambers, will always ask for advice on those issues. So it isn't simply, okay, you're this platform, and I have to shoot down your platform and try to score my points. No, the issues are complex, they're multi-layered, and by having that time to just chat, because they're not forced to vote at any particular point, right, they're trying to just get a deeper understanding, and so they become the advisors, of course, which used to be, in fact, another way of political decision making. You keep on talking till it becomes clear.
Yeah.
And here we reduce ourselves to, this is the platform, and that's why that's the party hat. So as soon as you're not even in an election year, everybody's always so worried about what your media, your messenger, is going to do with what you said.
Yeah.
If you actually say, Walter McLean, let's say, agrees with Bill Blakey, a conservative just agreed with NDP, you're undermining party solidarity or something, right?
Yeah.
And saying, no, okay, we have lots of common ground, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that would be maybe part of the question. Should we and how could we animate a different form of political conversation than this?
Well, I've always thought that the kind of the strict party line stuff is the result of the party leaders have too much control, and the way you kind of corrode their control is actually to do something undemocratic, which is to eliminate how you pick your leaders. Instead of doing it by all the party membership, just do it like the people in New Zealand do it, or I think it's still in Britain, caucus only, because they're immediately responsible. I mean, you still need a way of making sure your caucus is then responsible to the riding. So it's, I mean, there's another level to that. But part of the problem of party control is this anxiety that leaders have that they're very high control of their caucus. If just a little bit is lost, then they might lose all of it. And it's kind of the anxiety of the monopolist, right? They've got the monopoly, but if there's just a little bit of crack, they get really worried. Right? This is Bill Gates's words, right? So, I mean, there are institutional maneuvers that one can do. but institutions are always kind of a secondary kind of attribute.
Sorry, I missed the start of your talk, but I'm sure you have laid out some
I'm glad you could make it. Thanks for coming. It's a long drive.
I'd like you to speak again to the question of why politics requires friendship, especially if politics is what I think I heard you say that it was, or what it's become, which is a kind of an instrumental activity towards the security and service of individuals within the state somehow.
Yeah.
Which isn't a definition I'd want to land on, but especially if that's the case, why does politics require friendship?
Well, I probably didn't complete the thought. I wouldn't say that politics is simply kind of an instrumental good that serves the individual, because that is in a sense that gets us back to the beginning problem of the individualism, or of the problem of how conceiving of politics as a contract to, in a sense, is a public statement, but one that seeps into private. So public and private are not, vacuum tight categories. Mm-hmm. So I guess, in a sense, how one conceive of politics as a species of friendship is to get back to this notion of festivity, or of narrative, or of drama, or of plot. Give one example. Throughout the Second World War, when Churchill would go on the radio and kind of try to improve the mood of the English, he always frequently referred to our island story. This nation has the form of a story that moves through time. But as a story, there's kind of a plot, there are main characters, and also this story with a plot, and also very different characters, has a way of showing the unity of that society, because by saying we have an island story, it's saying I have a critical part in that island story. I mean, there are political myths that are pleasant or quaint. There are political myths that serve tyranny. So one would have to kind of flesh out the difference between island story, perhaps, versus the story of the folk, right? So I think Aristotle, for instance, I mean, at one point he describes the life of politics of the city as the common deliberations of the good. And, that would be conducted among factions, right? But what kind of is underneath and sustains those factions, why they persist in engaging it and why they don't, pull out their swords, is because they view themselves as part of this ongoing story. Josiah Ober has a book called Going On Together, how the Athenians went on together, even after the plague, even after all these horrible events that occurred to them, they carried on, right? And it has that kind of narrative understanding to it. And, the main advantage of that narrative understanding is that there's a plot, there's kind of a totality to it. You can see the outline of the story, but it never ends. And moreover, there are parts to it that make their own individual contributions. So I think politics, as kind of in a deeper sense, has that sense of participation in that story.
And friendship would be participation in the story, is that?
Would be, in a sense, you see your friendships as part of the story of the polis, but they have their own unique kind of story to them too. The story of anamnesis that Socrates explains to Phaedrus, has a political component to it, but it's also one that says, well, the experiences of the philosopher are in some ways more profound than those that are expressed by the statesman, or especially the tyrant, but the statesman's kind of four or five, I think, on the list of nine souls that he kind of lists. And just as a final point, a lot of the great statesmen of the world were fantastic storytellers. I mean, Churchill, maybe one of the greatest. Right? There's a great biography. It's a joint biography about Churchill and Roosevelt. And, you know, they spend weeks on weeks together during the war. And one of the things that John Meacham, the author of this joint biography, you know, called, I think, I can't remember the name of the book, but it's, you know, Churchill and Roosevelt's friendship. They love telling stories. And part of their process of how they became friends was, well, there's the English story roaring on around here, and there's the American story on, but, you know, soon they kind of merged. And it's really interesting to read about this.
Well, it's easier for Bush. He just has to look into somebody's eyes, and he knows he can trust Putin. No need to know Russian or stories.
That's right. Yeah. Well, he's not known for his stories. Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering if, you know, the fact is we do live in a mass society. Maybe it is possible to maintain friendships and develop a kind of politics that isn't dependent on the same kinds of values that friendships are dependent on. Just because, you know, there's no possibility of us having friendships in any meaningful sense of that word with the great bulk of people who share the same imagined community.
Perhaps.
That's the point of the contract theories, is to kind of move beyond, just in states where the scope is so large that you can't meaningfully talk about friendship anymore.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, the contract theory is a direct attack on the politics of friendship. And in fact, you could read all of Hobbes, and anything he says about friendship is always negative, and it's always in the context of these are potential conspiracies.
We talk about cronyism.
Cronyism. Yeah. That's the main way how publicly friendships that are politically relevant get addressed. Their friends are going to favor each other a little bit more, so we have to worry about this. And of course, there are lots of examples that explain why we should be worried about it. But I think I would resist, or I guess I would be skeptical of trying to come up with a sense of political principles or political virtues that exist independently of practices of friendship, simply because when somebody is engaged in politics, they have a whole history to them. They have a whole, I mean, we greet them when they become an MP or they write a letter to the newspaper, whatever their political activity is, as an individual who is coming out of a web of relationships, families, friends, and so forth, profession, that makes part of their moral ethos, part of their character. And in a sense, we would expect that their ability to listen, to attend, would have been shaped by those experiences. Or maybe to put it another way, we wouldn't expect somebody to be a decent political participant if they were not also decent to their beloveds, to the people who are closest to them. St. Augustine, for instance, you know, when you come into the Christian realm, of course, who is my neighbor becomes the central question, right? Is it my neighbor next door? Is it a fellow citizen? Or is it, you know, the unknown stranger on the other side of the world starving of hunger? And Augustine says, before he can answer any of that, he cites First Book of Timothy. I have the exact citation written down. But a person who ignores their own is worse than an infidel. A person who mistreats their own is worse than an infidel. So Augustine doesn't want us to be tribal. He doesn't want us to be only loving our own. But it's through our own that love gets practiced. And so that's one of the reasons I'm always a little bit wary of, can you make these two...
If you really love your own, you give them jobs, right? And you call nepotism...
Well, no. Well, I suppose if love is making them dependent on your goodwill.
No, but you can follow up on John's point, because I think that's important. And if you look at, let's say, you know, the you know, how Clinton and Monica or whatever dealt with in the media, yeah, as if that is now the true test of political capacity. And in contrast, you know, Chirac or Helmut Kohl, you know, have publicly known mistresses for 16 years. It doesn't become an issue. The issue is, are they in their political decisions expressing what care for the stranger, whatever term, yeah, you want to use, right? So it's a different version. If the friendship model becomes simply interpersonal familiar, and or we judge Napoleon on whatever relationship to Josephine or something, rather than what does he do in his strength, right? So how are you treating the nations? How are you treating, yeah, the people? I think that's sort of a shift. You know, so it doesn't necessarily have to go to, mm-hmm, contract, but it shows if we simply use a familiar model, mm-hmm, it may not be the adequate model for dealing with, you know, the multiple layers of what you're being called to do.
Yeah.
And I can find good, you know, whatever, psychological, social, and whatever reasons why you will find, if you want, sexual misdemeanors, whatever category you want to use, amongst the political elite, and, you know, the amount of stress and disconnectedness from, in fact, any kind of normalcy.
Yeah.
I mean, any celebrity is in the same world.
Yeah.
How do you survive Hollywood? How do you survive politics? Because, yeah, you're always in the media, so how can you ever,
yeah,
have relationships or whatever? You know, so we can give countless examples of that. So maybe one has to move into some slightly different model without undermining what you're trying to say, is that,
yeah,
you know, there should be a different version also of the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, just take the example of, you know, the ruler at the height of his power who does something decent, right? I mean, Aristotle says that, you know, this greatest test for virtue is acting justly when you have a lot of power, right? Because mm-hmm, that most fully displays one's moral capacities. In a sense, one would have to, I guess, the other kind of calculus that I suppose would come into that is, what is the reason for doing so? Is it because they're motivated by kind of a pure ethic? Is it because they seek glory, to be remembered well, right, to be spoken of well? And I suppose there, you could say, well, they want to have that, you know, Mulroney wrote this big, you know, voluminous self-autobiography, right? It's because he wants to be remembered well. He wants to be part of that story, but he wants to play the good guy in the story, right? And I don't want to reduce political ambition to simply, you know, the legacy question. But I think there are analogies to be drawn between that kind of broader notion of politics as the story, which can work into the calculus of why a ruler would act well with power. There are analogies that can be drawn between that kind of calculus and the friendship calculus, because of the story narrative parallel going on in both situations. Yeah, but it would require a little bit more collaboration.
Thank you so much, John.
Okay, thank you.